Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com. It's Green and Growing with Ashley Frasca.
Plants, flowers, trees, and stuff.
On 95.5 WSB.
Welcome to your Saturday morning. Ashley Frasca here hosting Green and Growing. Actually, I'm away today, but boy, do I have a full show for you. I am continuing, as promised, that March Outdoor Expert Series. My expert this week is going to be Jim Beard and the Bluebird Guy with some tips on attracting bluebirds to your landscape. And I kind of have a compilation of experts in this show from Landscape Pro University back at the end of January. I interviewed some of the presenters there, including folks that you've heard on the show before. And in this segment, I want to tackle pruning, right? We're coming out of the winter time. A lot of pruning should have been done over the course of the last couple of months. But I have some of my pruning friends, certified aesthetic pruner Norm Mittleider, back with me to talk a little bit about making pruning and transplanting a little bit easier on you. But then Rick Smith, the pruning guru, is going to tell us some of the pitfalls of improper pruning and the types you want to avoid. So first up is Norm from just a couple of weeks ago on the show here on Green and Growing. And we talk about pruning a lot, and it seems, Norm, that can be a little overwhelming for folks. They're so afraid to prune something incorrectly and kill it, or prune it at the wrong time. And then, you know, worst case scenario, they're not going to get flowers for that season. But nonetheless, you know, they'll have to wait another year, perhaps. But in you talking about pruning, really thinking ahead, knowing how to prune, first of all, the right pruning cut so that the tree is going to be able to seal over the wounds, right, and all that kind of thing, so it maintains health. But as you're mentioning, pruning for size or aesthetics or whatever the case may be in such a way that you can predict, okay, new growth is likely going to come from this pruning point, from where I'm making this cut.
Yes. Yeah. Whenever you're doing pruning, you're always wanting to think long term, but you're also wanting to remember that the pruning cut that you are making, you're telling the plant you don't want it to do this, you want it to do the other. And so you're each cut, you're training the plant to do what you would like it to do. Sometimes you don't want to overdo that because plants have their own mind, but basically you are redirecting growth every time you make a cut on a tree.
And now let's talk broadly about Japanese maples, because I do get a lot of questions about those each and every fall and winter, especially. And a lot of times I'll ping you, I'll text you and be like, Norm, I don't exactly know the answer to this. Help me out. But generally, overall, when do we want to prune Japanese maples? And let's go ahead and assume, people listening, it is for like a size reduction.
Typically, what you want to do with size reduction is, now would be okay to do modified, but you're right at the edge, because the tree is starting to wake up and the buds are starting to swell. Any major pruning you really would have wanted to have done like in January, February for size reduction. You would want to wait until April before you did any other trimming.
So let it focus on really leafing out. Leave it alone for just those couple of months that it's putting all the energy into leafing.
Absolutely.
Out.
Absolutely. And then, you know, ideally in the April time frame, because you've already made some major cuts in, you know, January, February, in April, May, what you can do is see how the tree responds. You might do some minor tweaking of some of the growth, because sometimes it'll really overproduce some growth and you might not want that at the time. So you can cut it back just a little bit to keep it more in check. And then, you know, watch it throughout the season and do any touch-up work in the fall period, which would be September, October.
And after putting on this wonderful fall show of just brilliant color, that's when it'll start to go dormant, right? The Japanese maples, like most trees, they're going to lose their leaves, they're deciduous, and go into dormancy.
Absolutely. Although there have been a couple of years where, because we've had a late frost, the leaves haven't been able to make that transition, so the leaves will actually stay on over winter.
Oh, my goodness. That's a rare thing.
Yep.
Abscission, that word. Abscission is when the tree knows to lose its leaves and they cut loose. We'll talk into Norm Mittleiter about Japanese maples. We'll get into so much more if you have questions about that. And we want to talk about transplanting, caring for them. Also, Japanese-inspired gardens. I mean, Norm's done a lot of design work as well. So if you have some questions about what would a Japanese maple include or a Japanese garden include, what are the features that I would need to have? But in asking you, too, about, you know, when to prune and care for the maples and things like that, we want to consider right plant, right place. So if we're thinking about putting a new Japanese maple into our landscape, we need to do our research, A, on the growth habit, B, what the size is going to be. That way we're not calling the Green and Growing radio show being like, oh, I need to transplant something. It's grown too big for its space, right?
Absolutely, Ashley. That's, you know, you go to a nursery and you look at the little tree and you're like, wow, that is so cute. And then you take it home and 5-10 years later, no longer little.
No. So, yep, right plant, right place. Do some research on that, folks. And another question we often get asked is transplanting. I got a tree, I put it in a spot, oh gosh, it got too big, or maybe it's not getting the sun or it's getting too much sun, but you've got to transplant it. If you want to save it, it's inevitable. So give us some general rules of thumb on transplanting a Japanese maple. Is it advisable to do? Is it possible?
Well, it depends on the size of the tree, how long you've let it stay that way.
Do you know a guy with an excavator?
Yes, absolutely. Sometimes I wish I had called one.
Yes.
My back, you know. But yes, when you're transplanting, there are certain times you want to do it and not do it. Certainly the fall period is a great time to do it. And then the greatest time is when the plant tree is dormant. So that would be January, February. But once the tree starts waking up, you do not, and I emphasize, do not want to move a Japanese maple after Valentine's Day and all through the month of March.
Well, think about how much energy it takes a tree to start to leaf out and then, you know, flower out if it's a flowering tree. But interrupting that process, throwing it in a new spot, and then it's going to get really hot in the summer, right? And that poor thing's just going to be so stressed out.
So stressed. And then again, if you know what you're doing, you after, you know, into April, May, June, July, August, September, you can successfully move a Japanese maple, but again, the emphasis on knowing. Because if you don't know what you should be doing when you've moved it, you may not have the success you had hoped for. So when you do transplant, you are cutting major roots typically on the tree.
Unintentionally, of course.
But necessarily.
Yeah.
So that limits the intake of water and nutrients to the tree. So to replace that means of getting that into the tree, you want to hydrate the foliage. In other words, mist the foliage.
Oh.
And that way it can take in some of that moisture and nutrients through the foliage.
And now, is this advisable, too, if we're transplanting something smaller? Maybe like, I mean, I know you've done it, azaleas, rhododendrons, camellia, same kind of rule of thumb?
Absolutely. Works with all your plants. You definitely don't want to do it when they're peaking at growth.
Okay. Now, what about reducing the size a little bit of pruning just to relieve some of the burden off the plant, but also to kind of make it more manageable to move so I don't break limbs or something like that?
Well, you can do that, but it really isn't necessary.
Okay.
There have been a lot of studies that have been done over the years to see the pluses and minuses, and it's been proven that you don't really benefit from trimming anything as you would think you would. However, you know, if you do want to trim a few things, like you say, so it's a little bit more manageable to move, that's fine. but it really isn't necessary.
Thank you so much to my guest, Norm Mittleider. And boy, as landscapers and gardeners, do we see things and they just get on your nerves? It just rubs you the wrong way, like when a pruning cut isn't made back to a growth point. So you've just got nubs sticking out of trees or shrubs or whatever. Well, I caught up with Rick Smith, the pruning guru, recently, and he's got a big one for you. Over the long term, things that you'll want to consider for sizing your shrubs properly.
I'll tell you, something that I've been seeing a lot lately is that, for an example, plants that have been sheared mechanically, for example, lower petalums, I see those damaged more than the lower petalums that have been pruned properly because they only have a thin layer of foliage because of they've been sheared. So that's what I've been seeing out there.
That's a really good observation, too. And when I drive along Town Lake Parkway in Woodstock, there's a stretch there that the hedges are alternated, right? They're little meatballs. There's a camellia, a laura pedlum, a camellia, a laura pedlum. And they're all pruned and cut to be the same size as one another. And when those camellias were blooming back in like October, November, there was only a few flowers on each. You almost wouldn't have even known they were camellias, because they've been sized so extremely, you know, limited that the landscape crews are cutting off the buds.
You know, there's a thing to be said with formal versus informal. And if you decide to do formal, which is where you're shearing everything into a tight ball, green meatball, as you said, or a square or Mickey Mouse, there's going to be a price to pay. One way or another, it may be the freeze, it may be defoliation in the center, and you just have a dome. There's a lot of reasons of why not this year.
Wow. If you've taken nothing else away from this show, what Rick just said right there is so key. And if that's your look, if that's your intention to have more of a formal, you know, boxwood hedge kind of look, get the right plant, right? Don't force a laura pedalum that can go crazy or a camellia that wants to be big and wants to flower. Don't force those into something they're not wanting to be, right?
Absolutely.
And when we come back, the top three things to do in the landscape this weekend for mid-March, and also some things, don't worry, that you can safely prune right now this time of year. Next on Green and Growing. The update on the weekend weather brought to you by Finley Roofing.
Green and Growing. Ashley Fraska's top three things to do this weekend.
All right, as promised, we'll get to an extensive list of things that you can be pruning now in just a moment. But number one, how about it's the time to fertilize tall fescue during its season of rapid growth. Always fertilize things when they are in active growth. Otherwise, that plant is not uptaking those nutrients. So for fescue, you know it's happiest between fall and early spring. You can apply fertilizer up to 3 times a year. Now would be the last application, and then not again until September and November. And remember to keep fescue mowed regularly, about once a week or maybe a little more often if it's growing vigorously. That's going to help with weed pressure. It's going to help choke out weeds if you keep them at bay and don't let them go to seed. That way they spread and become more. Number two, it's not too late to cut tattered monkey grass, liriope, liriope, however you say it. But a mower set to its highest setting, probably best to use for larger areas, or sharp hand pruners for smaller plantings, which is what I've done. A very simple short video on my Facebook page. Search Facebook for Green and Growing WSB. It may be kind of boring, but you get the picture. Number three, plant roses. Pick a spot where they'll receive at least 6 hours of sun a day. Ideally, a little bit more, though. Break up the dirt really well. Don't plant them too deeply. And do not plant roses in an area where plants in the past have died of rose rosette. You need to be aware of that, or your landscaper. Let them know the history in that spot. Okay, so for things to cut now, well, one of them was monkey grass. We just talked about that. Roses. I've gotten messages from a lot of you worried that you've missed the window for cutting maybe knockouts back. You haven't. I always try to do it around Valentine's Day. This year, I failed to do that. Yes, there's new growth on them, but cut them back to 10, 12 inches high. You're not going to hurt them. They're still going to have a flush of new growth all spring and summer. Panicle hydrangeas, the ones that are cone-shaped, that are like a grape, bunch grape shape, those are going to bloom in the summer on new wood. They've been bare and kind of leggy all winter long. You can cut those limbs back. Camellias that have finished blooming. You know, the japonicas are so pretty in the wintertime, and they're dropping petals like crazy. So you want to maybe cut those back to shape them. Forsythia is almost done. That makes me sad. That bright yellow flowering shrub, which is so pretty. Quince, winter honeysuckle, once their shows are over. Boxwoods, you can go to town with those. Make sure you don't have boxwood blight, though. If you do, that's a whole nother story. And hollies as well. And if you need help with pruning some of the bigger things, like shrubs, whether they're flowering or not, Walter Reeves published a, the Georgia Gardener, published a pruning calendar years ago in the Atlanta Journal and Constitution, still has it on his website. It's a grid. It's very, very simple to follow what months to prune a certain thing and which not to prune. So go to walterreeves.com and in the search bar type pruning calendar, and that's going to be really fun for you to look at. First day of spring is just around the corner. That's a good reason to follow me on Facebook, right? Search Facebook again for Green and Growing WSB. I post Thankful Thursdays. I try to post a word of the week on Mondays, something nature related that maybe is a word you've never heard of or a technique in the garden that I can expound on a little bit. And right now, hopefully the most popular things, highway horticulture and the word of the week, photo albums. So go to the Facebook page, go to photos and look at albums and really look at those two. This is the best time of year to enjoy the highway horticulture one. Weed of the week, you'll see pictures taken right from my own yard. One of the weeds you're seeing now, if you see grass that hasn't been mowed and it just looks like a short sea of like a light purple or really pretty purple, that could be dead nettle or henbit. So you'll learn the difference when you search this photo album on Facebook. Show content and so much more. So give me a like or a follow. When we come back, growing citrus in Georgia. It can be done. Sounds like a lot of fun. I'll be back with that next on Green and Growing on 95.5 WSB. Oh, yeah, the grass is green.
I'm gonna live where the green grass grows. The grass is always greener on the other side. Caterpillar to a butterfly.
It's Green and Growing with Ashley Frasca.
Plants, flowers, trees, and stuff.
On 95.5 WSB.
Good Saturday morning. You're listening to Green and Growing right here on 95.5 WSB. Happy to have you along. And you hear in the show's intro, plants, flowers, trees, and stuff. Well, we talk a lot of stuff on the show. And this falls into the category of trees, sure. But citrus. It's been a really cold winter. A lot of you are so anxious to grow citrus in Georgia. It can be a tricky proposition, but I finally have found a guest, and after 4 years of not really broaching this topic because I was scared, I have found Danny Trejo, who is the founder of Via Citrus Farm in Howie in the Hills, Florida, and that's just outside of Orlando. Danny, hey, welcome to North Georgia.
Hi, Ashley. Thank you for having me on.
So is it fair to say you're the founder, or is your dad the founder?
My dad has his own citrus nursery. He's had that for probably the mid-90s. He sells directly to garden centers, but I founded the e-commerce side, which is what I call Via Citrus. And so him and I put both him and I in that category. We've done that together.
And it's amazing, you and I talking offline, Danny, and your dad doing this and being in this business for 40 years. You didn't grow up thinking you were going to be a farmer, but how much you learned from him and you caught the bug, and here you are.
Yeah, I mean, growing on that citrus farm, being on a citrus nursery that started out as, you know, a 9-acre little nursery farm to what it is now, it's probably 80 acres on the greenhouse, being surrounded by citrus groves, you know, I tell everybody I lived in this like citrus bubble almost. And, you know, I walked out the door and smelled orange blossoms. And, you know, when people hear that, it thinks like, wow, that's amazing. But as a kid growing up, it didn't seem as amazing until I stepped away from it and missed it and reconnected with it.
Amazing. So finding a way to do this successfully is e-commerce via citrus trees from the family farm to the front door. So Danny, you're talking to an audience largely based in North Georgia who traditionally are like, aside from a Meyer lemon tree, I'm not even going to bother because we have, you know, really cold winters. But you probably have some good news for us that, hey, maybe we can grow our own citrus, right?
Most definitely can. And you'd be surprised, you know, Via Citrus has shipped trees to North Pole, Alaska, which I didn't think was a real place until I had to Google it, for Anchorage, Alaska. You know, and we mostly focus on 1 gallon indoor citrus trees, you know, 1 gallon, 7 by 7 inches. And we keep them that size because we primarily, you know, are selling these in New York State, on Colorado, in Oregon. And, you know, besides them being easier to ship, they're the perfect size to, you know, bring outdoors during the warmer months and indoors during the cold winter months.
Now, when you talk about that and they're grown in a 1 gallon pot, are they dwarf varieties? Do they stay small or are they going to become larger to where the homeowner is going to have to repot them eventually?
The beautiful thing about citrus is there are dwarf varieties. We don't offer the dwarf varieties. You know, most of our citrus trees come from the citrus cuttings, so they're not grafted. But our varieties kind of stay, you know, to size if you keep them pruned back. So that's what I mostly suggest to people is it'll keep the size. If you keep pruning it back, you might have to step up the pot size a little bit bigger. You know, you don't want it to get root bound. Or we sometimes suggest, you know, when you're repotting it, maybe do some simple root pruning, but not too much where it damages the tree.
And out of everything you ship, like you said, all over the country, what's your favorite variety to grow, or for the edible value, what's the best flavor?
Oh, my personal favorite is the calamansi. You know, the calamansi is very popular in Asia. I know Lunar New Year's was back in February, but it's very popular around the Asian community because it represents good fortune, you know, great health and wealth. And it blooms year round. That's what I love about it. It smells great. It blooms and fruits year round. It has small fruit. The taste, if you like tart, you know, it might be for you. If you don't, it might not be for you. But they make excellent marmalades and jellies and cakes out of them. But that's my personal favorite. It's the calamansi.
Now, when we're thinking about bringing potted citrus in and out, you know, especially in the wintertime months, it's so important if the temperature gets around even 20 degrees. I mean, below freezing is going to be a tricky proposition, of course. But varieties that you would recommend for listeners here in North Georgia that'll have a chance to bear fruit, considering they may be indoors for 4 to 5 months out of the year?
I strongly, again, recommend the calamansi. It grows well indoors, especially during the winter months, even throughout the whole year. The Meyer lemons also do a great job. There's also we also have some fun varieties. The yuzu, which is very popular, you know, in many flavors and drinks, is also a really fun one to grow in the winter months. They're actually known to be a little bit more cold hardy than most of the citrus trees. You know, they're typically found in the Japanese highlands, and they're reported to survive in the low teens.
Wow.
But I mostly tell you know, most of our customers, anything below 32 for long periods of time, try to avoid it. Let's just bring them indoors, or, you know, have some type of protective blankets around them.
And some of the varieties of citrus, folks, that Danny's mentioning here, you can see them on the website viacitrus.com. That's viacitrus.com. Speaking with the founder, Danny Trejo from Florida, this morning. And Danny, talk to us a little bit about your experience and the tips that you would give listeners on how to successfully overwinter citrus trees.
Great question. I think the key things of growing citrus indoors is direct sunlight. You know, so you want to have it near that window where it's getting at least 4 to 6 hours of direct sunlight. If you're not a good grow light, we have some grow light options on our website as well. It can be extremely helpful, especially over these colder months, and days are shorter as well. The watering schedule, you know, I wish I could be more scientific about it. I always tell people it's more like cooking than it is baking. Baking's
yes.
more scientific, right? You know, the watering schedule really depends on a bunch of variables. You know, your humidity levels inside, how much direct sunlight is kind of receiving once it's indoors. But your watering schedule is definitely going to change compared, you know, when you compare them to being outdoors and being indoors. So, you know, you'll have a higher rate of evaporation once it's receiving more sunlight. But also, you know, the low humidity that we have indoors during the wintertime is also going to dry it out faster. Definitely check your plants once it's indoors. You definitely don't want to overwater or underwater. And what we recommend is basically just simple finger test. You know, the first top inch of soil is dry to the touch, go ahead and water it.
Common sense watering. I preach that on the show all the time. You can't say a certain houseplant, it has to be watered every 7 days. You're right. All of the conditions surrounding it are going to determine how much. So you stick that finger in the soil and away you go. Well, Danny, tell us, if someone has brought in, say, a Meyer lemon tree, you know, and all of the leaves fall off, is that cause for concern, or is that just the tree trying to adapt to being indoors?
I would definitely say it's a cause for concern because it's not happy, right? Something's not right where it's not happy that it dropped all of its leaves. And most of the time that I see that happening is when we are taking it from an outdoor environment to an indoor environment. It's a huge shock to the plant sometimes. And then depending on the plant, you know, citrus can be very temperamental, and it can show you it's unhappy by dropping its leaves entirely. So when that happens, I don't think it's a major concern. I would just make sure not to move it around too much. Make sure that it's getting enough direct sunlight. Make sure that your watering schedule is great. If it's dropping leaves for other reasons, I would say be a little bit more concerned. It's dropping leaves because it's not getting enough water, It can drop its leaves because sometimes that grow light's way too close. So, you know, be careful on reading the instructions carefully on your grow light. But it can be various reasons on, you know, why it's dropping its leaves like that.
And talk about maybe one or two of the pests that a homeowner may experience with citrus trees. Is it different from any other house plant or kind of the same old characters?
It's the same typical characters, I would say. I mean, you might get some citrus scale on there, and it'll look, you know, like these white little scales on there. You might get spider mites on there as well. And what we recommend is insecticidal soap or neem oil. Those are two excellent options, which you can find, you know, at your local garden center. You know, I feel like an insecticidal soap will take care of most of the insects.
That's a good, easy fix in scouting out for pests, for sure. Well, Danny, the farm there in Howie in the Hills, Florida, just outside of Orlando. So naturally, in their natural environment, when are citrus trees blooming and when are they bearing fruit?
That's a great question. I think every variety has different schedules. You know, most of your oranges, like your navels and red navels, typically are fruiting around the wintertime. Your Meyer lemons and your calamansi are year-round. But citrus is mostly found in the subtropical areas, and that's something just to keep in mind as well when you're bringing it indoors. We're trying to replicate that environment as well, right? So if we're not successfully doing that, then the tree's probably not going to be blooming or fruiting during that period of time. That's why we mostly say, hey, in the warmer months, go ahead and take it outside. It's a bit more humid outside than it typically is. Sometimes I do recommend having a humidifier nearby to kind of replicate that subtropical environment as well, because, again, having our HVAC systems on during the cold winter months can definitely dry out the air.
Our Christmas cactus and things like that, if we can do it, it really benefits the plant greatly to bring those outside in the summer and let them kind of get charged up with that sunlight, right?
Absolutely. You know, I like to call that our citrus plants are more like, you know, patio citrus as well. I know we've kind of been tagged as like the indoor citrus company, but, you know, I really say citrus still needs to be outside. I think it thrives outside. It can grow successfully indoors quite well. But again, we need to replicate that subtropical environment. But if you have porches that we find here in Atlanta, Georgia, or the lanais or the patios, take advantage of that and definitely set it out in direct sunlight and watch it grow, watch it thrive.
That's going to be so much fun. Well, listen, Danny, I appreciate your time. So anybody listening that's really interested in trying some of your citrus trees, tell them how to go about doing that.
On Instagram, we're at Via Citrus. Our website is viacitrus.com. We have some frequently asked questions on there as well, some growing tips. But if you have citrus yourself and want some advice, I would say hit us up at help@viacitrus.com. Send us a picture of your citrus tree, and we'll do our best to kind of help you you know, successfully grow citrus anywhere.
Well, Danny Trejo of Via Citrus, so good to have you in North Georgia this morning. Thanks for taking the time.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Ashley.
Coming right back with the top three things to do in the landscape this weekend. And in hour number two, Landscape Pro University. From back at the end of January, some of the experts at the University of Georgia weigh in on what to look for this spring. Next on WSB. That update on the weekend weather brought to you by Finley Roofing.
Green and growing. Ashley Frasca's top three things to do this weekend.
So what a fun conversation with Danny there. Again, the website viacitrus.com. Learn a little bit about growing citrus in Georgia. And hey, hats off to all of you that have successfully grown Meyer lemons over the years. I've never tried it, but I'm anxious to. Number one this weekend, fertilize tall fescue during its season of rapid growth. That would be from fall to early spring. Apply fertilizer up to 3 times a year. This right now is the final fertilization probably, and then you don't have to worry about it again until September and then November. Number two, it's not too late to cut tattered monkey grass or liriope or liriope, however you pronounce it. A mower set to its highest setting is probably best to use for larger areas, or sharp hand pruners. Just grab some clumps by the hand and cut them off. That's what I do with the plantings around the mailbox. And number three, plant roses. Pick a spot where they'll receive at least 6 hours of sun a day. Ideally more, though, and break up that dirt really well. Don't plant roses in an area where plants in the past have died of rose rosette. That is so important to remember. You'll want to think of alternate plantings. All right, coming up, so much more to come in the show. Landscape Pro University, some of the faculty members at the University of Georgia took time with me at this Georgia Urban Ag Council event about a month ago, and they're telling us what diseases, what pests, and what things with the turf to look out for this coming spring. We're going to hear from Dr. Alan Armitage, a new book coming out this month from Dr. A, and what to look for on plant tags, how to decipher some of that so you can make sure you do best by your plants. And then bluebirds. Jim Beard and the Bluebird Guy from Green Meadows Preserve joins me. So you'll want to stay tuned. You're listening to Green and Growing on 95.5 WSB.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.